In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about consciousness and some ideas about what it is and where it comes from. It is something that has intrigued scientists, philosophers, thinkers of various kinds for a long, long time. That is the nature of consciousness. And it seems that even today, as we have come to know a lot more about the brain and how it is structured and how it functions, and we even have technologies where we can watch the brain at work, we can watch people think, there still seem to be questions about what is going on in the brain that gives rise to consciousness and our subjective thoughts and emotions. Our guest in this part of the show is Gerald Edelman, and he is one of America's leading neuroscientists. And he spent quite a lot of time thinking about this question, trying to understand the way the brain works and the origins of consciousness. And he's written a lot about it. He has a new book out which summarizes his thinking, and it's intended for a general reader, not just for other kinds of psychologists and neurobiologists. The book is titled Wider Than the Sky, The Phenomenal Gift of Consciousness, and it's published by the Yale University Press and has come out fairly recently. So if you're interested in the subject, you can certainly take a look at it. Our guest, Gerald Edelman, is director of the Neurosciences Institute and president of Neurosciences Research Foundation. He is also professor and chair of the Department of Neurobiology at the Scripps Research Institute in California, and also is a Nobel Prize winner. He won the prize for physiology or medicine in 1972. Questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and also toll-free 800-222-9455 if you're interested in joining in the conversation. Dr. Edelman, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. I have to begin by confessing that I feel my grasp of this material is pretty tenuous. So you will have to humor me, as I will be asking some questions that are probably even more basic than the kind of level that you try to write the book on.
That's quite all right.
And I say, you know, it's no fault of yours that I feel like I have such a shaky grasp. Because it is indeed a complicated thing, and I guess that certainly one of the things that one comes away from is the understanding that in thinking about consciousness, you cannot point to a place in the brain and say it is here, that it is something that it is the result of the interaction of a number of things. And perhaps also different brain function, because it seems that it has something to do with learning, and it has something to do with perception, and it has something to do with memory, and the way those things all work together.
That is right. All of what you have said is perfectly on point.
To begin, if people aren't quite sure what it is we're talking about, we ought to discuss consciousness a little bit, mm-hmm. and to talk about what it is.
All right. Let me start by saying that, of course, we all know what it is in an instinctual way. It is what you lose when you fall into a deep dreamless slumber and what you regain when you wake up. It is perhaps what you appear to lose when the anesthesiologist says we're going to have to say goodbye to each other for a while and subjects you to general anesthesia. But, of course, that isn't adequate to answer your question. Consciousness, first of all, as William James, the great psychologist and philosopher, pointed out in what is still the best description of it in terms of its phenomenal properties, consciousness is a process, not a thing. Mm-hmm. It's very important to make sure that you don't try to point to it as a thing. It's an ongoing process. It's a process that depends upon the structure and function of the brain, as you said. And it's a process that has remarkable properties, one of which is that a conscious scene, the one you're conscious of now and that I am, is unitary. It isn't just of one thing. It's of a whole bunch of things. It's what you hear, what you smell, what you're thinking inside, some vague feelings, mood, and all of that. So it's all of one piece in terms of the subject or the self. But second of all, and seemingly contradictory, conscious states can be enormously diverse and differentiated. So, for example, if you thought of all your college classmates or a movie by Eisenstein and thought of all the scenes, there would be billions of possible internal states which you can access with your consciousness. Of course, these states occur in a kind of temporal order. They're serial. One thing changes into the other. And they have your brain, of course, in being conscious, has to construct this kind of scene. Philosophers talk about the fact that consciousness has intentionality, which is a somewhat confusing term. It doesn't refer to intention. It refers to the fact that conscious states are about something, usually. They're about what you're seeing, this scene, whatever. They're not just open-ended. And, of course, they have an extraordinarily widespread access to all of your kinds of thoughts, memories, sensations, and what have you. Mm-hmm. They're subjective, above all, and they reflect what people in philosophy have called the qualia, the property of the greenness of green and the warmness of warmth, etc. And they're sort of concerned with how you're situated in the world, and they give rise to feelings of familiarity or its lack. Forgive the long monologue, but that might be a list of what determines the properties of consciousness.
Well, as you say, that at any given moment, the brain is receiving a great deal of information about the world that surrounds us. And at the same time, there's also information about our internal states, what's going on inside of us. And that from second to second, all of that is being processed and put together into this picture that we get at any time, which, of course, from second to second can change a great deal. And that experience throughout the day changes a lot. Now, the animals, I'm sure, also something similar is going on. They are, after all, processing the same kind of information about their environment and something about their internal state and forming this picture that they have of the world as well. But so perhaps they have consciousness at some level, but it is not what we have. As far as we know, maybe we're not quite sure of our very close relatives, the higher primates, but it's consciousness is one of those things that we feel is probably uniquely human, that other animals don't have it. So what is the difference between that picture that my cat has of his world and the one that I have?
Okay. Well, first of all, I noticed that you said consciousness is one of those things instead of one of those products. But there we are. You see, let's go back for a moment before I address your question to a big issue.
Yes.
The issue was put forth by René Descartes, the founder of modern philosophy, the French philosopher, who did a little physics but was very, very interested in this idea of thinking and consciousness. And he proposed that, what he said was, cogito ergo sum. I can think, and therefore I am. Je pense, donc je suis. And therefore, I don't even relent to the idea that a demon can confuse me about my existence. And on the grounds of that, he divided all of existence into two things. One was extended things, res extensa, which physics could look into and science could look into, and res cogitans, thinking things, which you couldn't. And they weren't extended in time and space. This is known as dualism, and a particular form of dualism called substance dualism. And I believe it is wrong, although what you might say about Descartes is you wish you could play his wrong notes. in any case, I say this as preface to a response to your question about animals. Mm-hmm. Here is the problem. We have to define primary consciousness, which is what I call the remembered present. The process of being able to put together all the different modalities of sight, hearing, touch, feeling, whatever, into a scene, but not having any concept of a social self or a past or a future, even though you might have long-term memory. And I believe that's what animals have, and of course we have it too. But we have in addition what I call higher order consciousness, and that relates to semantics, the ability to refer, the ability to use tokens or words, what have you, and symbols in such a way that we're sort of freed from the remembered present. Now, you always have to have the remembered present. That's the one that's going on when you're not particularly thinking about a phrase or whatever. You're just sitting there in a rest state. But you also have higher order consciousness in which the tokens of your vocabulary and your language allow yourself to be freed from the world. And at that point, you have a social self defined by your upbringing. And the fact that you're in a speech community, you also have a concept of the past and the future. So you sort of have a remembered present like an animal, we assume, but you also have these concepts of past and future which enable you to tell a story inside, to write a novel, to tell a joke, etc. Animals don't have that capacity to report. And so we have a funny situation here. The fact is the human is the best subject to look for neural correlates of consciousness, to examine the brain to see what's going on, because they can report to you. But animals can only do that indirectly. And therefore, while they're valuable and have structures just like ours that we suspect are underlying consciousness, they're not as good an immediate substrate. So I can suspect that my dog is conscious. In fact, I can believe it, but it's very hard to prove in the same way that I can by doing experiments on human beings.
Yeah. I have some callers, and I want to get to them. Just
sure.
Real quick, just to get back to Descartes for just a moment, that there are some people that might argue that this process that we're talking about, consciousness, is not amenable to scientific analysis.
There are indeed.
But you are not one of them.
No, I can tell you one of them of some distinction, a man named Colin McGinn, who's a philosopher, who's what some people have derisively called a new mysterian, a person who insists that there, of course, is a basis in the brain, but our brain is not able to put its arms around it. I don't believe that. I believe we're beginning to make scientific progress and show brain correlates of consciousness. Mm.
The other question is, do you think that language and the development of language is also is essential to something that goes hand in hand with the development of consciousness?
Yes, that's a very good question. The fact is, you have to sort of split it out. For instance, apes have not a true language like us, chimpanzees or bonobos. They have semantic capability. They can refer symbolically to things, either with computer programs or whatever. But they don't seem to have syntax, so they can't weave a tale and tell a Shakespearean narrative where we can. So it's important to sort of separate that out. I believe for higher order consciousness of the kind I talked about, and I think chimps have some of that, in its highest development, you have to have language.
We have several callers. Perhaps I should also introduce again our guest, Gerald Edelman. He's director of the Neurosciences Institute. He is also professor and chair of the Department of Neurobiology at the Scripps Research Institute, which is in La Jolla. Is that right?
That's right. Both are in La Jolla. They're separate institutions, but they're in La Jolla.
And if you would like to read more in greater depth on this subject, you should look for his book, Wider Than the Sky, The Phenomenal Gift of Consciousness. Yale University Press is the publisher. We have several people here who would like to join in the conversation. We will start with a caller in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Wonderful show. Sir, I wonder if you, in your book, address spiritual consciousness. I've been reading books which I guess I refer to as expanded consciousness, and things such as descriptions such as our spiritual consciousness is not within our body, but our bodies are within our spiritual consciousness. And I'm just curious if you address that in the book or have any comments about that.
Well, I will say it, first of all, that I do have some comments, but that I don't address it in explicit form, in a very long form, in the book. So I better lay my cards on the table. Of course, what we just referred to, Mr. Inge and myself, about language, opens this whole subject up to a range of thought which can also be a little confusing and ambiguous. For example, the word has been used as social consciousness. You just said spiritual consciousness. Mm-hmm. All of the things that we are enabled to do with our conscious brain as human beings with speech. But I have to put my cards on the table and say that I believe that dualism, the kind of thing that Descartes talked about, is not a feasible answer. The idea that there's some separate realm outside of our body. I believe the way to put it is our body, our brain is embodied, and consciousness depends on the body as much as the brain, and then the body is embedded inside a social framework. Now, within that framework, we have all kinds of hints of dualistic ideas that's implicit to our language. A person who has some illness can say, why is my body doing this to me? When in fact he is the incorporated results of all the processes going on in his body and brain together. So while there are religious concepts and there are philosophical concepts that talk about extracorporeal, out-of-body experiences, which can be quite real, it doesn't mean, as far as I am concerned, that they are events because there's something extra outside there. It all depends on what's going on in the body.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We'll go to a caller in nearby community, Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. As strange as it may sound, a couple of us were sitting around just the other night talking about this, and we wondered ourselves to ourselves, how do you know if a group of people in the past did have self-awareness or conscience? And, well, you know, you can easily figure it out with Rome and Greece and those things because they left writings and stuff. But how about when you get into a pre-recorded history, something like the Neanderthal? Now, they may have had a language. They may not. The only thing they've left behind are some tools, maybe a grave site or two, and some skeletons. How would we come about the thought of whether they had a conscience or not?
Well, that is a very good question indeed. It verges on the issue of archaeology and paleontology, both two domains where the evidence is sketchy at best. All scientific evidence is in a certain way sketchy. Science is not completely determined, but in these cases it's very difficult indeed. And I guess the only way you can do it is by inference on the grounds of homology. They look like humans. They have skeletons like humans. There is a human line of evolution, etc. And this brings up a very interesting question, your question, which is how did consciousness evolve and at what time? So that is a question that we can discuss if you wish. But the answer, short and simple, is just as I can't tell with the same precision as I can with you in various brain scanning mechanisms and experiments that my dog is conscious, we can only infer by homology and a sort of line of thought whether Neanderthals were conscious in the sense that we're saying. Suspicion is that they have brain parts that are like ours that are necessary but not sufficient for consciousness.
So the fact that somebody would make a tool doesn't necessarily mean that they have any conscience.
That's right. The word necessarily is the potent word there. The suggestion is, though, that if they are, for instance, able to bury their dead in some symbolic form, that they are capable of a projection into some future state. And that is, in an extended way like that, in a big social ceremony, that is not prima facie, but reasonable evidence that they must have been able to have a concept of the future.
Which is essentially conscious.
That's right.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. We will go on. And the next caller is in Champaign on line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'd just like to mention that I heard recently that Harvard is wanting to expand its study of science among undergraduates and maybe the standards. And I'm just wondering, how do you, as a scientist, see the relationship between science and the study of language like linguistics? And even someone has brought up spirituality. Some people may be on one side of spirituality, some people may be very stuck on revelation. But
yep.
I'm just wondering, you mentioned Descartes, for example, and that seems to lead up to the scientific method. So I'm wondering, in the 21st century, how do you see science or the scientific method? Has it changed in any way?
That's an extraordinarily good question.
And what about, you know, postmodernist thought? Does that come in and influence?
Well, I hope
science?
Not, but I'll get to that.
Okay.
Your question is very, very important because it has to do with the potential divorce between science and the humanities. And for that, we have to go back to another man in history besides Descartes, someone slightly prior called Galileo Galilei, the man who might justifiably be called the origin of Western scientific method and certainly of mathematical physics. And Alfred North Whitehead, the philosopher and mathematician, once said the mind was removed from nature at the very beginnings of Western science, one by Descartes and the other by Galileo. Galileo, for reasons having to do with what he wanted to investigate, which was physics, he said, I know if there are no animals, there wouldn't be any green and warm or something like that, but I want to get on with what I want to do, so I won't pay attention to that. Descartes, as I said, was an explicit dualist. The mind was put back into nature, I think, at the time of William James at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries and other people working on psychology. So now the question is, how do you fit it in? Well, it's obvious, number one, that it's one of the most important traits. It's what we most treasure. It's what we, I hope, will be last to give up in a medical sense. If you don't have the capacity to be conscious, you're effectively dead, even if your vital signs continue. And so it's a very important thing in two ways. One, what does it mean if you understand it, and how can you? And second of all, what does it mean for the way human beings think, science or no? So let me start with the latter idea. I think it's extremely important to understand how the brain gives rise to its own functions, and including consciousness above all. And in order to do that, you have to have some vision of how the brain itself works. And the fact is, people who have looked at this question and have looked at the science, who are in the liberal arts, I'll give you an example in a moment, have become excited about the possibility of including it in the curriculum and showing that, in a way, it's a kind of completion of Darwin's program. Now, I've just given a big mouthful. Mr. Inge, shall I go on and say what it's all
yes,
about?
Please do.
Okay. Well, Darwin, in 1869, Charles Darwin was very vexed with his friend Alfred Wallace, who, in fact, was the co-discoverer of the theory of natural selection, because Wallace said he didn't think the mind and brain of man could have evolved by natural selection, because natives who had brains just as large as those of British citizens and the upper classes didn't have math and abstract reasoning, so it couldn't be possible. Darwin was quite upset, and he said, I hope you have not too seriously murdered your child and my own, meaning natural selection. Now, I mention all of this because we have to ask how consciousness evolved. And we think by looking at the brain and looking at medicine and looking at brain scans and whatever, that we can tell what the necessary components are in the brain. But more than that, we think we have an idea of how the brain works. And it doesn't look like it works like a computer. It looks much more like it works like an evolutionary garden, like Darwin's program. And so in a certain way, studying these subjects and consciousness in new curricula opens up a whole way of looking at how humans have knowledge, how art is related to science, and what have you. And indeed, I ought to mention that Elizabeth Coleman, who's president of Bennington College, has, in fact, said that they want to start a whole new curriculum based on this idea. So I believe that when we do understand how this all goes together, we'll have a much better picture of how the humanities relate to the sciences. The idea being that sciences don't exhaust everything. Once you have conscious language, you can think of all kinds of Shakespearean plots. And the question is, well, how do the two connect?
Yes, and could you explain your title then? It doesn't sound like the title of a scientific book, Wider Than the Sky, the Phenomenal Gift of Consciousness.
It's the title of a poem by a great American genius named Emily Dickinson, the great poet.
Okay.
And I can tell you, if you'd like, Mr. Inge, I can sort of tell you the first verse or so.
Sure.
What's brilliant about this is in about 1862, Emily Dickinson wrote this poem, "The brain is wider than the sky, for put them side by side, the one the other will contain with ease and you beside. The brain is deeper than the sea, for hold them blue to blue, the one the other will absorb as sponges buckets do. The brain is just the weight of God, for heft them pound for pound, and they will differ if they do, as syllable from sound." And so the brain is wider than the sky, and that's the source of my title. Notice, by the way, she was really talking about the mind, but she never did it that way. She used the brain.
Right, and how does that relate to mysticism?
Well, I have this to say, that, of course, I'm a practicing scientist, and while I admit, and so did William James in The Variety of Religious Experience, his book based on the Gifford lectures, while I admit that mysticism is a state of mind, I don't think that science is consistent with mystical ideas, per se.
Okay,
in other words, it's possible, you see, to have all kinds of ideas, and one must never argue against that, but demonstrably truthful ideas that you can prove without waving your hands around, that's another story.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go on. We have another caller. This is someone in Champaign, and pardon me, Noah, I think this is someone in Mattoon. On line number two, I think. Yes, go ahead.
I read a book by E.O. Wilson who dealt with a lot of the association between the science and the arts, particularly with...
Must have been the book called Consilience.
Yes, yes. And he dealt with these issues, I think, very well. My question, though, regards children with autism.
Yeah.
And whether you would feel that, of course, autism is a variable illness, but in the more classic forms, whether these individuals possess consciousness.
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, yes. Autism, of course, is a kind of tragedy in the sense that individuals can range from very greatly affected persons who can't really function in society to people who have syndromes that are related to autism that allow them to function but have a terrible problem in recognizing certain social facts about people, what people have sometimes called a theory of mind, that they lack a theory of mind. The big advance in autism, and there's still much to understand, is that it is not just a question of that you brought your child up wrong. There's definite evidence that there are organic brain damage in various parts of the brain that underlie the various syndromes of autism. And so there's little evidence that they are not conscious, but there's some evidence that their consciousness can't extend to, for example, recognizing another person as being a person, as having a theory of mind. Children, human children who don't have autism, in very short order, but from age two on certainly, have a very obvious dawning notion of the other, of the mother, of the fact that there might be a person who feels, etc. And they have that expanded higher order consciousness. It looks like the consciousness of autistic children in the extreme degree that they lack the capacity to recognize that higher order consciousness. That doesn't mean they aren't conscious, however.
Well, the best way I heard it described is that the classic autistic child is not interested in other people, and the more higher functioning are interested in other people, but they just don't know how to do it.
Well, yes, exactly right. The persons who have autism who've actually made successful careers in society admit that they just don't get certain nuances in the way we treat each other.
Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Let me again introduce our guest, Dr. Gerald Edelman. He is professor and chair of the Department of Neurobiology at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California. Winner of the Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine in 1972. Has done a lot of research in this area of consciousness and has authored a book that summarizes what he has learned and some of his thoughts. For a general reader, the title of his book is Wider Than the Sky, The Phenomenal Gift of Consciousness, and it's published by the Yale University Press. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As we have discussed, the idea of consciousness and the process of consciousness is a result of brain structure and the way that its various parts function together. And we have talked about what consciousness is, that if, for example, it is that thing that enables, that makes it possible for us to think about what we did yesterday, what we are doing now, and what we will do tomorrow. And that is, if we did not have consciousness, there would only be now. There wouldn't be a future, there wouldn't be a past, there would only be now. If we pick something, for example, the concept of the future, that we are distinct beings in time, and that we are now, but we also were yesterday, and that we will be tomorrow, and in some way we're the same and yet different in all of those times. Is it possible to look at the brain and its structures and function and actually try and explain, for example, how it is that we have this idea of the future and that we're here now, but that tomorrow, well, we'll be there and we'll be us, but somehow it will be different.
Very good indeed. It comes back to what we originally talked about, this sense of the conscious scene as being unitary, all of a piece, and yet, while it's unitary, changing from moment to moment. So we do have this concept of time and duration as a result of our consciousness, without a question, although it's not like a clock and it's not like a computer. And out of language and the definition of a self, we can, with words, construct the notion of a future. And, of course, we count a tale of the past. But there's an interesting thing here, and that is that the brain, we can get to that business of measuring the brain in relation to your question, the brain constructs. The brain has to make a story, usually, except perhaps, as your guest has talked about, in autism and schizophrenia. The brain always makes closure. For example, there's a blind spot in your eye where the optic nerve goes in your retina, which can't be sensitive to light, yet you fill it in and are not aware of it until your ophthalmologist does it. Well, in a larger sense, so is true of our sense of time. We have what I call the Heraclitean illusion, after Heraclitus, the Greek philosopher who said you can't step in the same river twice, which is that there's a point moving from the past through the present to the future. But in fact, the only present that's scientifically real is Einsteinian present right now, the remembered present. What the others are concepts. Nonetheless, our brain gives us the sense of moving from the past through the present to the future. Now, we can get some hint from what we have been measuring at the Neurosciences Institute as to the answer to your question. When we do brain scans of people as they become conscious of an object, and I won't go into the details of the experiment right now in the interest of time, what we see is that the way the brain responds is unique in each case. There's a kind of brain fingerprint in the dynamics of how the different areas of the brain, and it's all over the brain, that occur in and become active when you become conscious of an object. Funny thing is, and the intriguing thing is, no two people are alike. Everybody is unique, and therefore there may be some sense of the continuity of self that's being reflected in all the events that happen to you uniquely in the history of this universe and all that happens to me, etc. We're beginning to see a hint of that kind of thing in our brain scans.
Well, that's also another one of these intriguing questions about consciousness. How is it that we have a sense of self, that we have this idea that we are a unique,
Absolutely.
Distinct individual being, that there are these other beings that we live with, and we know that they also are distinct individual beings, and while we share a great deal, that
there's privacy,
and that indeed when you know you really have to question assumptions of shared perception, that we all see the same world and we see it the same well. No, in fact, we probably really don't.
No, we don't.
That we have, you know, it's that thing where you can take a picture of somebody and show it to them and they'll recognize that's them, but if you take a picture of your dog and show it to the dog, you know, the dog doesn't know, oh, hey, nice picture of me. No, it doesn't work that way.
Well said. Look, well, the central issue is, you put your finger on it, as you did before. It's central in terms of higher order consciousness, this notion of the self. But just consider this. Your body, as I said, which is interacting with your brain is embodied, your body is giving signals from itself to the brain even prior to anything you can talk about as human experience. Even in the womb, even in a fetus, there is a certain amount of what they call proprioceptive sense. So all the stuff from inside the body and all the positions of the limbs, for instance, of the spontaneous movement of the fetus, there's certainly a physiological mechanism that distinguishes that from some pressure that might move the limb from outside. So right from the very beginning, even before we're born, we're getting huge amounts of signals from ourself, from our body as a biological self. Now, when after we're born, we develop capacities of memory and correlation and things of that kind, we develop a social self, a named self. And at the same time, however, that self is, in some full sense, completely private. If you wanted to know every last thing that's happening inside you and me now, that is not available except to the body of the person who has it. The philosopher Tom Nagel once said it this way, how do you know what it's like to be a bat? Okay. And so how do you know what I'm thinking now explicitly in every last detail? Well, you don't. You know what I'm projecting in this language. Nonetheless, the notion of self is central, and it is one of the core issues of consciousness.
Well, that leads to a question, whether it is something that we are born with or whether it is something that in a way we teach ourselves as we experience the world.
It is a capacity that leads to an enhanced process. It happens dynamically as a result of our body interacting with other bodies. But of course, the so-called qualia, the sensed experiences, are are our own and will be uniquely our own and non-trivially so. It's very important in terms of the creativity of individuals.
Yeah.
Let me say it another way and say the most important thing I could possibly say is that I think, of course, consciousness of the kind we have evolved. I'm not absolutely sure of this, but I think it evolved at the time that the so-called therapsid reptiles became birds and vertebrates and various mammals. Now, what that gave in the Darwinian sense was an enormous adaptive capacity, because then an animal that had this conscious ability could construct scenes of all kinds of things and make a huge number of discriminations that weren't possible for an animal that lacked it. So that's the selective value of having the capacity for consciousness and the brain structures underlying it. And the qualia, the things you say, warm, green, this, feeling, pain, all of those are those discriminations. So the famous philosophical problem of how do we explain qualia and the greenness of green is, no, you don't explain them in the sense of what's happening to you privately, but we both know what pain is, and we both know what green is, unless this one of us is colorblind. Mm. And in fact, the qualia problem is solved in the sense that we know how they are distinguished, because the nerves that give rise to smell and the ones to the hearing and the ones to the various sight and what have you, and all the brain areas are well known to be different. And so what's important about qualia is they are discriminations and distinctions, and they're the ones that enable us to fantasy, to have language, to do all these wonderful things.
Let's talk with some other listeners. I'll give them an opportunity to talk with you in the order they came in, starting with Champagne, and that would be line one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
Okay. Earlier on, your guest mentioned the problem of dualism and monism, or dualism, I guess, and he said that the idea that that consciousness is centered in some realm outside of reality to which we cannot have access is an idea that he rejects. And I guess, of course, that's always opened up a huge philosophical can of worms, because most people experience consciousness as being a source of freedom. And I guess what I'm wondering is if, and of course, freedom then being limited by the idea that somehow your material world determines your consciousness. Mm-hmm. So if our consciousness is in our material reality, how would you, as a scientist, approach then the question of both our experience of consciousness as being free, that is not determined entirely by our material circumstances,
sure,
and second of all, our desire to view ourselves as free beings, or should we just give that up entirely and accept the idea that it's really our material circumstances that fashion our consciousness?
Very well said.
I'll just hang up there.
Excellent questions. Thank you very much.
Let me put it this way. What you're referring to has at the boundaries of it that famous vexed problem of free will that philosophers have talked about. Let me start by saying we have to say something about how consciousness can or cannot cause things. Well, since I said consciousness is a process, and since my book points out the evidence for why that process is entailed by certain neural dynamics and neural activity in the brain, I do not believe that consciousness is causal. I think that the processes underlying it, the neural processes, are causal, and they are faithful. That is, if I have a neural process that gives rise to a feeling of joy or of pain or of green or whatever, it doesn't trick me. So that there's no problem in talking as if consciousness is causal, except if you think that that means there's a spooky outside where consciousness floats around. So the second point I would make is, yes, we do have this notion that we are free, and this relates to the notion of free will. Now, as a scientist, I have to admit that matters are determined, and they're determined by the material order, which is closed, because if you assume that it isn't, and it's determined by some spooky consciousness, you have to rip down a lot of scientific laws, one of the most important of which is the second law of thermodynamics, which is you can't get something for nothing. In fact, you can't even convert all energy completely into work. But be it as it may, we have, at least at the most extreme case, an illusion of conscious will. We have the idea that, yes, I can raise my arm, but the body of empirical evidence suggests, the reason you can raise your arm is that there are all kinds of neurons firing inside. Now, does this mean, having said that I believe that that's the case, that you are not able to think all of these things? You certainly may. And if one finds that useful, that's fine. It simply isn't sustainable in terms of scientific evidence.
All right, let's go to Urbana, next, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
What does the study of consciousness aid? How does it aid us in understanding depression? I know it's an adaption process.
Yes.
I'll let you expand on that. That's an interest area.
All right. Sure. Thank you.
Well, I hope I don't go on too much of a devious track here, but there are systems in the brain that we call value systems. You know, the brain consists of an incredible number of neural cells, of neurons. For instance, the cortex of your brain, which is responsible in toto for a good part of the contents of your consciousness, has 30 billion neurons and 1 billion connections. If you just counted one per second, you'd finish counting them, just counting them 32 million years later. So these work, these connections, these synapses, by releasing neurotransmitters into a cleft from one neuron to another when there's excitation. And that's all very well. But on top of that, the brain has already inherited from evolution so-called value systems, and they involve the release of neurotransmitters across large swatches of the brain. I'll give you an example in a moment. In the manner of a leaky garden hose, not at this neuron or that neuron, but all over an area. Now, I'm afraid I have to use some fancy words here. There's a region, for instance, called the blue spot, the locus coeruleus, which releases the neurotransmitter noradrenaline when you hear a crackling noise or an explosion or anything surprising. There's another one that rewards you when you learn something called the dopaminergic system, which uses the neurotransmitter dopamine. There's a cholinergic system, acetylcholine. I could go on like this. There are about six such systems, and they set up values of a kind you're literally born with. Now, one of them that's pretty important is called the Raphe nucleus, and that releases a transmitter called serotonin. And deviations in the amount of serotonin can be behind the phenomenon of depression. It's not the only thing, but as you know, some of these drugs, the serotonin uptake inhibitors, reuptake inhibitors, are in fact effective against the syndrome of depression. So certainly the change in consciousness that comes from depression relates to this so-called neuropharmacology and the excess or lack of these kinds of transmitters. So, there's more to it than meets the eye, though, because, for instance, in recent attempts surgically to relieve Parkinsonism, which is due to defect in dopamine, when they put electrodes in a certain place to stimulate certain nuclei of the brain and therefore counteract Parkinsonism, patients have reported, who are conscious while this happening, that they all of a sudden feel deeply depressed. So obviously this is a very, very complex system, but we're beginning to understand something of the chemistry behind it.
All right, let's go to the next caller, and this is someone in Champaign on line three. Hello?
Yes, I haven't heard all of your programs, so you may have answered my question. I taught my dog the difference between wait and no, so if I said wait, she would go and sit quietly until I was ready to do what she wanted, to take her out or whatever.
Yep.
So does this not indicate some concept that the dog had of future?
That's a debatable issue. You see, let me go back to a very famous experiment, a phenomenon in the 19th century of a horse who was called Clever Hans in Vienna, who looked like he could count. And the funny thing is that his trainer believed that he could count and didn't realize until it was studied much later that the trainer was giving the horse a bunch of cues that determined his responses. So the problem with what you've said is that there's nothing wrong with that, and I believe that that is exactly what a dog would do. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the dog has a concept of the future. It means that he's learned, and dogs can learn marvelously and pay attention marvelously, he has learned to associate that word wait with a certain set of acts, and then the other word with another set of acts. the idea that that could be due to her concept of the future is one we unfortunately can't test, but there are other indications. Well, let me say it another way, and this is a cruel statement, but forgive me, it doesn't relate to your dog. If I kick a dog, the next time he sees me, he may bite me or run away. But mm-hmm. even though I'm a professor, he doesn't sit around in the meantime plotting to remove my tenure. That may happen in Champaign-Urbana, but it doesn't happen in La Jolla.
Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. To Chicago, this is line four.
All I could say is, wow, this is worthy of any Nobel Prize discussion, and I greatly appreciate this program.
Thank you.
We are a bioelectric chemical magnetic body, as some people have referred to us, and we're certainly influenced by all the things that are assaulting as well as feeding us. Do you think that the impact of pollution in the environment is not being played up enough to relegate the importance of our future status as humans to the point where we may really be shortchanging ourselves in areas of creativity and imagination and thought. The handwriting's on the wall in terms of the effects of the environment on the water, air, and food. Do you think we're really in...
Your question is quite profound. I'm no expert in this, but I have enough knowledge, I think, and enough contact with people who have much more knowledge than myself to say we are facing a dire future if we don't use our consciousness to address these issues. Unfortunately, it turns out that, in fact, the way we usually use our consciousness is rather short-term. There are aspects in our life where we project a long thing, but to get it into potential events that might become parts of history sometime in the far future doesn't seem to influence people terribly much. What we can hope for, however, is as we understand more and more, and is to get people more sensitive to the early warning signs. That has been a constant problem of humanity. It seems to be a constant problem in our nation today, that we have the ability, and we even have some of the technology to deal with these problems, but no one quite feels it his particular urgent case. He has many other things, or she has many other things to worry about.
One more question.
Up a profound issue.
One more question. In terms of maintaining your ideal, or you might say, brain balance nutritionally, do you go along with some ideas that some health practitioners are advocating for supplementation of sorts that they're recommending for let alone dealing with the future Alzheimer epidemic that we're facing?
I see, yes. Well, I can't really answer that question because I don't have the specifics, but in general, yes, we know there are certain elements that you have to have or you will suffer brain damage. Obviously, that was in the early triumph of vitamins, that certain vitamins, if you didn't have them, would cause brain damage, if the lack of them would cause brain damage. But the difficulty is the idea of the nostrum that you get in the organic food store that says this is going to make you smarter or this, that, or the other thing. So far, it's not been founded. There are people studying in neuroscience what happens at the synapse to get memory, because synapses are essential for memory, even though they're not identical to it. And that work may ultimately lead to a rational supplementation and hopefully some kind of drug or substance which will not have too dire a set of side effects.
One last question, and unfortunately we don't have very much time. You talked about the brain, the human brain as a structure or collection of structures that has evolved, and consciousness as a process that has evolved. Do you think that our brains and perhaps our consciousness are continuing to evolve?
Well, let me say it another way. I think as a species, we necessarily continue to evolve. Mm. That is to say, Darwin, the greatest of all biological theorists, theory seems to be very strongly substantiated. And while we can do things with our consciousness locally that go far beyond evolutionary matters, it doesn't mean that evolution has stopped. The only problem is you can't predict what it's going to be like in a million years. It's even harder than the problem of history you study in school. So, of course, I believe that we will evolve. But how, of course, is an issue that relates to unknown events.
Well, our guest, Gerald Edelman, he is the he's professor and chair of the Department of Neurobiology at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California. The book, if you'd like to read about it, is Wider Than the Sky, The Phenomenal Gift of Consciousness, published by the Yale University Press. And Dr. Edelman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you much, Mr. Inge, and thank you, our listeners.